This is an oral history interview with Jim Ford in the archives of the Mansfield Library on July 20th, 1984 for the Smoke Jumpers Oral History Project. Mr. Ford, I'd like to start by asking you, when did you begin flying?
I began flying in 1947.
Where was that at?
I was working for the Fish and Wildlife Service and down on Fort Peck Game Range, down out of Fort Peck.
Why did you become a pilot?
Well, it was a useful tool in my chosen profession at the time, which was wildlife. And an airplane is a very useful tool in game management and wildlife enforcement.
What kind of steps did you have to go through to get your pilot's license?
Well, I didn't have a whole bunch of money and working. And I had a friend who had a Piper Cub airplane, and he taught me how to fly in it. But when I went to take my exam, the examiner wouldn't accept it because he didn't have a instructor's certificate, so I had to go and do it all over again.
What kind of planes were you flying back then?
Oh, mostly Cubs, Piper Cubs, various horsepower.
When did you start flying smoke jumpers?
In 1963, I believe.
What kind of planes were you flying for the jumpers?
Well, started out with Twin Beach and then spent most of my time flying for tri-motor jumpers here and in Grangeville.
Did those Ford tri-motors handle very well? Or?
Oh, they handle real well. They're just like a big Cub. I remember somebody asked old Bob Johnson, I think, one time, what the speed was on an old Ford tri-motor, and he said, take off 80, cruise 80, stall 80. Well, that's not quite right, but it's.
Were you flying for Johnson Brothers at the time?
Yes.
How many other pilots were flying for Johnson Brothers?
Gosh, I think one time there we had 21 pilots.
And how many of those were working for flying Forest Service contracts?
Well, a good share of them had Forest Service contracts of varying kinds, either jumpers, patrol, helicopters, at one stage or another, I think most of them did fly for small Forest Service contracts, either of one type or another.
What would they use helicopters for?
They used helicopters for smoke jumper retrieval. And after jumpers on a fire, they walk out to a helispot or cut a helispot, and they'd pick them up with a helicopter, or they used it sometimes for supplying, sometimes for reconnaissance work, and transportation of personnel.
Did you ever do any flying for water bombing?
Very little. I did little, but very little. I was rated in TBM for borate, but I did very little of that.
How would you make an approach with plane for water bombing? Is there any special way that the plane had to come in?
Well, you always had to be very careful when you come in over a fire. Generally, that was weather was hot and usually the wind gusty and whatnot, and you always had to be sure that you had a way out, and because you were low and right over the trees, and just make sure that you had a way out.
How high would you be flying?
Not very high sometimes. Treetop level.
Is there any difference when you're flying jumpers?
quite a little difference. One of the, well, there's a couple, several differences. One is that you always had to, when you're flying jumpers, you always kept in the back of your mind the welfare of the jumpers was primary, and where you're other flying, you had just the welfare of yourself to consider. And we always, or I did anyway, always considered the jumpers in the flying.
Can you describe to me how you would be flying the plane for a drop of the jumpers?
Well, it depend upon where the drop was going to be made. You would pick the terrain, and in cooperation with the jumper foreman that was generally with you, you'd pick out a spot to drop the jumpers where they had an opening, preferably an opening so it wouldn't be a timber jump, preferably not on a side hill and not in rocks or anything like that. We'd pick the spot out. Some of the spots you might have a little difficulty because of the winds or something else. You always took that into consideration. And then after we picked the spots, we'd come and over at altitude and generally 1,200-1,500 feet or so, depending upon terrain and conditions. And the spotter foreman, he would drop streamers. Streamers, three streamers would go down, and you'd came down at about the same rate of speed and the same drift as a jumper would. And, if the streamers come in all right and conditions look good, we'd come around and drop the jumpers sometimes, one or two man stick or three or whatever it was. Also, depending upon the fire, you into consideration before the jump, you would make sure that they weren't going to get into any dangerous position as the fire was moving, and also that some of the places, if there was a lot of wind, the steep hillside or rocks, it could have a mishap when they land, and we'd pick a different spot, or sometimes we canceled entirely and wouldn't drop them.
Do you feel that mountain flying is particularly treacherous flying?
Any flying can be treacherous. I don't know as I'd use the word treacherous. Anything can be treacherous, if you want to call it that. Crossing the street can be damn treacherous sometimes. But mountain flying is like anything else. If it's you do it right, proper skills and precautions, I don't think it's any worse than any other flying.
When you're in the air, how do you keep in contact with the spotter?
Well, with the old Fords, we didn't have any internal communication. It was just yelling in each other's ear and hand signals.
It's a pretty loud plane to fly.
Yes, it's noisy. Mm-hmm. It's noisy. I'm just nearly deaf in my left ear from it, because when you're sitting in the pilot seat, that prop and engine's sitting right here, right beside you.
Did you ever experience any kind of mechanical difficulties in flight?
A few, but nothing major. A few.
Do you care to tell me about one of them?
Well, nothing Nothing really major.
Did you ever have to make an emergency landing?
Not with smoke jumpers, no. I have in other airplanes, but not with smoke jumpers.
What about some of the pilots who were flying for Johnson Brothers while you were flying? Were there any near misses or?
Well, yeah. One of the pilots lost an outboard engine, right outboard engine on Ford over in Idaho, Elk City, one time. Maybe you probably already knew about that. And a piece of prop broke off, and before he could get it shut down, it vibrated the engine, broke it off the stand, and he commanded. Mm-hmm. But there was a strip right there, and he still had two good engines. Some of the jumpers, he had some jumpers with him, and they bailed out.
How would you characterize the pilots that were flying for Johnson Brothers?
Very good. They just, the pilots, 99% of them, were very good. They're very good pilots. Very good generally. I don't like everything else. There's a bad apple once in a while, but 99% were strictly A1.
As an organization, Johnson Brothers Flying Service, was it well run?
I thought it was very well run. I liked the way that it was run. Our equipment was not all spit and polish and new. We had a lot of old equipment, but the maintenance of it was just first class and superb. And we used to, a good share of us, we flew when there was flying to be done, and when there wasn't flying to be done, we worked in the shop. As mechanics, most of the pilots out there, a good share of them, they were not only pilots, well-qualified pilots, they were well-qualified mechanics also. And we used to have a standard rule in the shop back there that any mechanic or anybody that worked on an airplane when they went out that and if there's anything major, that when the pilot test flew it, the mechanic went along. And some of the new mechanics that come down there, they were a little apprehensive with that, but it was a good rule.
You feel there's an advantage for being a pilot and a mechanic?
Yes, there is very much, particularly when you're out in outlying districts, like a lot of the Forest Service flying is. You might be out in a backcountry strip or over some place like we never had a mechanic at Grangeville. I flew for out of Grangeville, and there's a definite advantage to being a mechanic and know how the machinery operates. Yes.
Do you feel you have to put a lot of trust in a mechanic that's working on your plane?
Bear a lot of trust. Yes, a lot of trust.
What about the mechanics that Johnson Brothers had? Were they good?
They were good. It was a very, very good shop. And they'd not... mechanics and the shop foremen certified a said an airplane was okay in engine, that had no qualms about flying whatsoever.
Was there any one pilot out of Johnson Brothers that stood head and shoulders above the rest as being?
That's an awful tough question.
Yeah.
We have lots of pilots and lots of good ones. Kenny Roth was a real good pilot. Jack Hughes was a very good pilot.
you guys develop a pretty good feeling of camaraderie between pilots?
Yes, yeah. There was good camaraderie, and there was a little competition and vying too, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that was there from day one, or was it trust that you had to earn?
I think you had to earn your trust in your place, which is only good, right, and proper that you didn't come in and you weren't accepted and trusted right off the bat. You had to earn your spot, which I thought it's good. It's any place, hell, if you don't earn your spot and they're not worth your salt, then it's.
How do you feel about Forest Service using private contractors to fly?
Well, I think that the Forest Service should use private contractors to fly. I think if there's a proper cost accounting in the end, it's cheaper, and the competition out in the private sector, I think, is good, and you probably get somebody will probably chastise me for it, but I think that you get through the competition process in the private sector, private competition, I think you get a better product in the end.
How does the Flying Service go about getting a Forest Service contract?
They have to bid on it. And it's generally, well, a low bidder that has the proper equipment and can furnish there's a lot of rules and parameters that they have to go through.
Now, did Johnson Brothers have all the flying business for the Forest Service here in Missoula?
No, they didn't. Just some years they had most of it, but there was a lot of some of the people come in on Johnson's generally had the jumper contracts and this sort of thing, but there was other people that would come in and bid on the some of them got in on the patrol work, some of them got in on the helicopter work, the borate work. And there was they didn't have an exclusive on it. They were had a little bit the edge, I think, but I think it was only right that they did, because they spent a lot of time, money, and effort on the research in the early stages and the development of both smoke jumping and spraying and borate dropping. The first borate dropping was tried and done and experimented with Ford Tri-Motor, and a lot of this stuff was done on the cuff of Johnson's for the Forest Service, and they received no compensation for it.
How'd that test turn out for the borate?
I wasn't here at that time.
You weren't here?
I know about it from people that were here.
Okay, during the fire season, would you have to stay at the base waiting for a call?
You spent a good share of your time there, and the daylight hours, and you had to keep them notified as to where you were at all times, or they could get a hold of you, even at night and evening. You were on call 24 hours a day.
How long would it take you from the minute you heard a fire call to be into the air?
Depending upon where it was, but we used to average less than 5 minutes over in Greensville.
How does Greensville compare to the base here in Missoula?
Well, it's smaller, and the pilots used to bunk and stay right with the smoke jumpers, and everybody was there together. And it's just a more small type, family type operation. And it's nice.
Do you feel there's an advantage to having the pilots and the jumpers based together like that?
I think it was, yes. I think it was. I really do. You get more to know each other. You get more trust or distrust, whatever. But mostly it's trust, whatever. Well, I can remember over at Grangeville, I think the second year I was there, we were talking about jumping, and one of the guys said, "Jesus, you ought to try it. It's great." So I decided that maybe I ought to see what it's like from the other end. So the guys had me jump a couple times off the packing table and suited up, and I went up and jumped, see what it's like from their end.
What were you thinking of when you're standing there at the red door of the plane, ready to go up there?
Nothing. I was just. I really wasn't. I wasn't thinking of anything. I was just sitting there waiting for the pat on the leg to the time to go, and I was just anticipation more than anything else. It wasn't strictly anticipation, I guess.
You feel that gave you any insights by go ahead and trying jumping?
Well, I think it gave me a little more appreciation of the jumper's angle. I know what they're going through, at least what some of the thoughts were, whatnot that they were thinking when they were going through. I never did fire jump, but every season I'd jump once or twice just for keeping my hand in.
Is that the kind of thing you feel the pilot should be exposed to?
Oh, not everybody, no, I don't think so. But it was kind of, as far as I was concerned, it was kind of neat.
What kind of altitude and airspeed do you have when you're letting the jumpers out?
Oh, just depending upon the condition, 1,200 feet above the spot, and airspeed of about 80 with the roll forward, 75 feet.
Is there any one fire that stands out in your mind as being the most memorable fire that you flew?
Yes. Well, it's, I don't know, is it? You'd consider it really a fire, but we were dropping on a fire in Bargaman Creek, the mouth of Bargaman Creek, down on the Salmon River, and we were putting the jumpers out on a ridge. There's a little short ridge right in the center of Bargaman Creek, and we put the jumpers out on that. We were making our circle out over the Salmon River, and on the third pass, when we were coming by, a B-52 flew right underneath us.
Where did it come from? Was there?
They were trying to make a run to get under the radar and flying up the Salmon River. And if he had come just a little bit later, we'd have been right down at his altitude when we were making the cargo runs. It was kind of startling to see him coming. He just filled the whole canyon.
Mm-hmm. How many men would be in a plane for a jump?
Well, it just depend. Generally, when we go out on a fire call out of Grangeville, if we was a two-man, three-man fire, whatever it was, we'd pretty near always take an extra crew along, and just in case we saw a fire and put jumpers on, going or coming, and in case we needed more when we got there, because the old Ford didn't carry that many more. Sometimes we'd just go right out and do the patrol work and the jumping at the same time, load it up with a bunch of jumpers, and if it was a bad fire season, and we had a thunderstorm going through. We'd just load up and follow the thunderstorm through, and the fire's there and jump. They don't do that anymore. We used to do that.
Is there any particular country that you like flying in more than others?
No, I didn't have any preference for any at all.
What would you do during your free time when you didn't have to be on call for flying?
When I didn't have to be on call for flying?
Yeah, when, like, say, fire season's over.
Fire season's over. That was one thing about working for Johnson's that I liked very, very well. During the summer and the fire season, you'd put in hellacious hours. But when it was over, you could go hunting and go fishing and do whatever you wanted to do.
Did your flying time drop considerably then after the fire season?
Yeah, generally. Mm-hmm. And you drop back, and I was one of the pilots that was on a year-round basis with Johnson. Fly, but trips, and I also did some instruction and worked in the shop during the winter and off season.
What kind of flights would you have to make during the winter?
Oh, mostly commercial flights, like you take ambulance trips or business trips. Somebody wanted to fly air transportation, mm-hmm. and or instruction, students of varying kinds.
Did you ever make any search rescue flights?
Yes, lots of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a lot of that. Do some snow survey work in the wintertime. So.
When you get the message that a pilot's down, they can't find the plane, what happens? How do they assemble people to do this? What goes on during a rescue?
Well, generally the first thing that goes is that somebody will go out where they think that along the route and see if they can't see what happened or find them or something. That's generally the first thing that would do it. Somebody comes up missing and he's on a flight from here to McCall or someplace. You'd fly the route that he would take, and or the route that you figured that he'd take or said that he would take and whatnot, and see if you couldn't find him. And then it would develop into an organized search. All the aircraft owners and pilots would, and had a search coordinator who would assign sectors and everybody fly it systematically, and drainages and
so on. Were there any rescue missions that you were involved in where you found the person right off the bat, or did it take a while to find these people?
No, it depends. Sometimes it takes a while, sometimes you find them right off the bat.
Did you ever make any dry runs? You're going to go take the jumpers out and the weather's too bad and you can't?
Yes. Yeah, made some of them. There was several, not a whole bunch, but there are several where you get out and the weather'd be too bad. Either I remember a few times where visibility was bad and a few times where the conditions on the ground were bad. The wind was blowing bad and it just wasn't considered safe. We didn't consider it safe to generally the pilot and the spotter, the jumper foreman would confer and if we didn't think it was safe for the jumpers, we'd turn the jump down.
Whose decision was that to make?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whose decision it was to make. It was made between the pilot and the jumper foreman and spotter. I suppose it was mainly the spotter and the jumper's decision to make, but generally the pilot had some input into it.
Did you ever have any jumpers get injured after exiting your plane?
One time, yes.
Would you like to tell me what happened?
Well, I got a back injury on a rock. Tough landing. Sent a crew in and took him out.
How would you characterize the safety record of the Smoke Jumpers organization?
Very, very good. I would classify it very, very good. It's not the safest occupation in the world, and considering all of the attributes and the aspects of it, I'd say the record is very good.
What about safety record over Johnson's?
I think it speaks for itself. It was very good.
How would Johnson's compare to, say, a flying service, say, a McCall or Redmond?
Well, of course, McCall, most of McCall was the subsidiary of Johnson's, but with Johnson's, the maintenance was good, and if there was a pilot that was not flying as he should, the word gets around pretty fast among the Forest Service people, the jumpers, the personnel of the company, and everything else. The word gets around if a pilot is not operating in a safe manner and operating the way he should, and either Bob or Jack Hughes, Bob Johnson or Jack Hughes would talk to him, and if that didn't, and then the pilots themselves would pretty well police it, and if that didn't do the job, he went down the road.
Did you ever see anything like that happen yourself?
Yes.
Did you ever see any instances where you felt a pilot was not physically fit to fly a plane?
No. Well.
Overexerting, maybe. Tired. Too tired to fly.
No, not really. Mm-hmm. Not really.
Do you feel that these pilots that flew Vietnam that are now flying, do you feel that they're more willing to take a risk with a helicopter than, say, someone who did not fly in Vietnam?
I don't know. I don't have that. I don't have that association enough anymore. I couldn't give a.
When did you leave Johnson Brothers?
About 68.
And what did you do then?
Went back to work for the Fish and Game Department.
And do you still keep in contact with the guys that you flew with?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good chair. Good
what
chair.
About on a professional basis?
Yes, I still fly, and I fly for the department, and I fly for myself personally.
So you're flying. Part of your job is to fly for the Forest Service.
Well,
or the
no, it's not part of my job, but it's something that I do in connection with my job. It's easier for me to know what's going on out in the region and do a little flying now and then.
Do you feel that any of the practices that they used during the experimental stage of the smoke jumping were a bad idea, something that didn't quite work?
Yeah, there were, well, hell, anything new, and there are certain, you can't get the right situation or the right set of circumstances every time. It's more or less a trial and error basis, and hell, anything that's goes along that way. The only way you can't make mistakes is not do anything. Mm-hmm. So, but I, any of the mistakes or risks that were taken were qualified risks and good, honest mistakes after everybody had considered things and it was a judgment call.
Well, how many flights would you make a year? Average thing.
I don't know.
Is it daily?
Yeah, yeah. There was very few days when I was working for, I don't know. We used to put in a lot of time, do a lot of flying.
Did you ever have to
sometimes you'd fly everything from a Cub to a DC-3.
Did you ever have to make more than one trip to a fire?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that common?
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly if you get a project fire, and then with the Fords, we flew a lot of cargo into project fire.
Was it easier to fly a load of cargo or a load of jumpers?
Oh, easier to fly a load of jumpers.
Why is that?
Well, you take the jumpers jumped at a higher altitude. You didn't have to get down slow, and it wasn't the putting the cargo in is pretty tricky and critical unless you can scatter it all over the country. And with the jumpers, they have quite a little control of those chutes coming down and higher altitude.
How would you make a cargo run? Can you describe the sequence of events from the past to the dropping stuff out?
Well, after you drop the jumpers and then you drop the cargo. A lot of times you drop the cargo closer to the fire than you'd drop the jumpers because the wasn't a safety factor with the cargo, depending upon terrain and everything else, you'd drop the cargo from 100 to 500 feet, and you make a pass over and you pick out the spot where you were going to drop the cargo, and generally the spotter and the smoke jumper foreman was the cargo kicker, and you'd make a pass over it to get the conditions, and then you'd line it up and the cargo kicker or the spotter would go over and make your pass and you'd signal him when to kick it.
Whose decision was it as to what spot would be chosen for?
Between the spotter and the pilot decision. They always conferred on where you were going to drop.
What would be an ideal spot for cargo?
An ideal spot for cargo was a bald spot on a ridge with no trees to hang up in and a good approach, and you can just come in and put them in and when you got done, all the chutes would be laying right there, touching one another.
Is that pretty rare?
Not entirely.
Do you ever have any problems getting cargo on?
Generally not. Generally not. Sometimes remember a cargo run or two where it was so rough, the air was so rough, and that cargo kicker had to hang on with one hand and work with the other hand. He couldn't. Stand up because the air was so dangerous.
Do you ever have to make any really long flights to get to fire?
Oh, generally not long flights. Particularly some of the boys in if there were longer flights, a lot of times they'd send out the DC-2 or 3s, which were faster airplanes than the old Ford and generally ours was. Within 100 miles, I'd say.
So. Once you arrived at the fire, how would you know where the jumpers had to land?
Well, we'd look at the fire and pick out spotter, and we'd spotter generally be up in the co-pilot seat, and we'd fly around and we'd look and pick out spot where generally at that time where they're going to put the jumper, and then the spot where we were going to put the cargo, and proceed to move.
Is that the kind of thing that you have to learn, or does that come with experience flying?
Well, I think it comes with experience flying, experience dropping smoke jumpers, and experience with mountain flying, and experience with dropping smoke jumpers and cargo. It's one of the things that you learn through doing. Learn what you can do and what you can't do, and what's the best place and what's not the best place, and what you have success with and what you don't have success with.
Well, I think I've about exhausted my list of questions. I've got something else I'd like to ask. After you've dropped your cargo, you've let the jumpers out, what would you do? What was the sequence of events? Would you head back to
base? Well, after you put the jumpers out, you'd look and make sure that you got the okay sign, that everything was okay. Mm-hmm. And you would go and drop the cargo, and you'd look and make sure that the cargo and everything was all right, and then earlier we didn't have radios, and we didn't have radio contact with the jumpers on the ground, but later we had radio contact and we could talk to them on the ground and see that everything was all right, and then we'd make a reconnaissance around, and if there was any information that they should have as to what the fire was doing or where to go, we'd relay it to them, and then head on back to base.
Do you feel any different when you know that you're flying smoke jumpers, or when you're flying cargo, or is it all the same attitude towards flying?
Not entirely. You have a little more, I think, when you're flying jumpers, you feel a little responsibility towards the jumpers and their safety, and where with you're flying cargo, there's just you and the cargo kicker generally, and load of cargo, but you use, you might have a little more apprehension when you're flying jumpers than when you were just cargo, when you had a live cargo rather than a bunch of supplies or something.
How do you feel when you see that signal from the jumpers that they're okay?
It makes you feel good.
Have you ever had a signal that said there was something wrong?
Yeah, several times.
What do you do in an instance like
that?
You're
pretty apprehensive then. The only thing we could do is we went earlier before we had radio contact. We had ground signals as to what to do, and then later we had whether they needed help or additional help or not. And later we'd talk to them on the radio, and we call back and either get some assistance in, and if it had to be evacuated, cut a hell of a spot, or if they needed some additional help with jumpers, and get more jumpers, a medical crew or whatever.
Before the radio, how would they signal you and tell you what they needed?
Well, I can't remember. We had a set bunch of ground signals as to what they'd lay out, things, what they need. I can't recall. It's been 30 years ago. I can't recall exactly what the signals were, but they would signal whether they were okay, and if they weren't okay, if they needed help, or what. We had a standard set of signals.
Were you involved with Johnson Brothers during the Mangles fire?
No, I was not. I was working for the Fish and Game Department here at that time.
Here in Missoula? How did you feel when word broke of that?
I felt very bad.
Did that affect, do you feel that might have affected your flying of jumpers later on?
No, it was, yes, I think it did, because the something of that nature was always in the back of my mind, that was one of the things that you always looked at in considerations, and you always had that in the back of your mind, and you thought about that when you go in to put some jumpers on a fire.
Okay, I'm going to have to turn the tape. Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat that answer. We got cut off on the end of the tape there. We were talking about the Mangles fire.
Yeah, the Man Gulch fire, you always, when you went into the drop jumpers, it was always in the back of your mind, and you always thought and think of what the situation could be, and try to evaluate the situation down there so that they wouldn't get into another situation like that if the fire did blow up and drop them someplace where they're on the safe side.
Were there any other, you say, problems that other pilots experienced that you ever thought about while you were flying?
Well, yes, there's, of course, you communicate back and forth problems and things that you had, but with the various pilots, and you not only learn by your experience, but you learn by experience of others, and those are it's part of the learning process. Yes.
This is a kind of an odd question. Red Skies Over Montana, the movie. Mm-hmm. Did you have any connection with that whatsoever?
Well, very little. A little bit.
Did Johnson Brothers do any flying for that movie?
I think they did. A little bit.
Did that? How'd the guys feel about having to fly for that?
Well, I don't know. I didn't fly for it. I'd rather someone did so rather than I myself.
How do you see the future of the smoke jumpers?
I think it's a good tool. There's several things about it. It's a good tool in firefighting. I think it's a good tool in training and utilization of Forest Service personnel. I think the people going to where they get most of their jumpers from, kids going to school, a lot of men forestry, I think it's very good training for them. And you look into the higher echelons of the Forest Service now, I think the forest smoke jumpers are a better grade. Gives them a little more insight, something gives them a little edge, and they're future years in resource management, I think they're a whole lot better for it, myself. I do.
As the size of roadless areas decrease, do you feel that there'll be less of a need for smoke jumpers?
There probably will, but the roadless areas are decreasing, but there's still a lot of roadless areas. And I think there'll be a need for smoke jumpers. And while it's a little more expensive, it's a lot quicker. And I think you got a better grade of firefighters in a smoke jumper than you have in a typical ground pounder.
Do you feel there's been any change in the attitude of smoke jumpers from when you first started flying them up to the present?
I haven't had that much to do with smoke jumpers in recent years, but I did not observe any change in attitude of smoke jumpers while I was working. It was always, well, good, and there was always a comrade feeling between the smoke jumpers and smoke jumpers and the pilots and the people that are associated with them, which was good. I think it was good, and I think that carried on through years. And like I said previously, I think they make a better Forest Service employee, a better resource manager for having gone through the smoke jumper process.
When smoke jumpers would be called to another base, would a pilot from Missoula fly them the distance to the other base?
Generally.
Is it more cost effective to use a helicopter in certain places, do you feel, than to use an airplane?
I think so. There's a place for both. I don't know. I don't know what, really how cost-effective goes, but with the new helicopters that they got and the speed and so forth, they're pretty good too.
Well, I can't think of anything else I'd like to ask. Is there anything you think that I've missed that you'd like to add?
No, not particularly.
Okay, I'd like to say thanks.